Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, January 21st, 2024. I'm your reader, Sharon Falgido, and we start with the front page today, Educators Study AEAs Before Making Changes, by Grace King of the Gazette. Educators across Iowa are asking for a year-long comprehensive study of area education agencies before changes are made, as Governor Kim Reynolds proposes, to the institutions that have served families and teachers for 50 years. The changes the governor is asking lawmakers to approve early this year would upend the way area education agencies function and what services they are allowed to provide. Reynolds said the agencies have become too top-heavy and strayed from their mission of serving students with disabilities, while Iowa's special education students perform below national averages. Over the years, AEAs have expanded well beyond the scope of special education, providing a wide array of other offerings for teachers, schools, and districts, Reynolds wrote in an open letter Friday to Iowans. These range from athletic coaching certification, cybersecurity, and classroom book sets to providing graphic design and printing. In fact, only about one-third of the services AEAs list today are focused on supporting children with disabilities. One of the services the proposal questions is the expertise AEAs provide to districts with curriculum. But Jessica Bartelt, a special education teacher at Washington Elementary School in the Mount Vernon Community School District, said she relies on the local agency when the district makes curriculum decisions. Curriculum consultants with Grant Wood AEA, which are part of the general education services that could be in doubt under the legislation, ensure the content aligns with Iowa's academic standards. Bartelt students need curriculum that includes slow enough lessons at the pace my students need to learn, she said. This includes multisensory learning that incorporates things like sound and physical movement, she said. If it takes a typical student exposure to a lesson 3 times to learn, it takes one of my students 10 times, Bartelt said. Grant Wood AEA, one of 9 agencies across the state, serves 74,000 students in public and accredited non-public schools in 7 counties in eastern Iowa, including Lynn and Johnson, and employs about 500 staff. Mount Vernon Superintendent Greg Bottenhorst said professional learning opportunities offered to teachers through area education agencies like Grant Wood are crucial and extremely valuable. That's anything from curriculum to suicide prevention, and they've done a great job supporting and mentoring new teachers, Bottenhorst said. The governor's bill, filed January 10th as House Study Bill 542 and Senate Study Bill 3073, would prohibit Iowa's area education agencies that provide expertise to educators and families from offering services beyond special education for students. School districts could also drop their current agency and look elsewhere for services. On Thursday, Reynolds proposed loosening a restriction in her bill, allowing agencies to continue providing general education and media services if requested by school districts and approved by the Iowa Department of Education. The agencies also would continue to provide all special education services they do now, including Child Find and early access for children from birth to 3 years of age, Reynolds said. An amendment to the bill outlining those changes hadn't been filed as of Friday. Ryan Wise, dean of the School of Education at Drake University, who was director of the Iowa Department of Education from 2015 to 2020 under former Governor Branstad and then Reynolds, said he appreciates the spirit of the bill and its intent to maximize the effectiveness and efficiency of AEAs. He said he hopes legislators ensure any changes made to AEAs are sustainable and positively impact local schools, students, and families. I would love to see a comprehensive review of the system before we make very rapid changes that could negatively impact schools and kids, Wise said, echoing leaders of area education agencies, educators, and lawmakers who were interviewed for this article. Maria Cashman, executive director of special education for Grant Wood AEA, said she is concerned about abandoning an existing system for one that has yet to be created if the bill were to pass in its current form. Cashman said many data points need to be taken into account when creating a plan to improve outcomes for students who receive special education services. For each student in special education, a legal document is created with the input of the child's parent and educators called an individualized education program. Because these plans are so individualized, they're an important measure to consider when talking about student achievement, Cashman said. Because the proposal envisions school districts coming and going between AEAs and private companies, some educators and parents worry this would force AEAs to charge a fee for the service they provide. If that happens, we would be much less nimble at being able to meet the needs of students. Frequently, students move in and out of districts, and as this happens, the needs will change, Cashman said. The passion around this issue is wonderful, Cashman said. We have to continue to work together to meet the needs of our children. But Cashman said no representative from the State Education Department or the governor's office has reached out to her or to Grantwood AEA to consult on the bill. We work hard to be responsive to local needs. We encourage continuing that collaborative approach and having multiple people at the table to problem solve and figure out how to continue to improve services for students, she said. We always take a collaborative approach, and we're focused on continuous improvement. Also from the front page, Weeks of Heavy Snow Could Help Ease Drought, by Brittany J. Miller of the Gazette. Several winter storms have barreled through the Midwest since the start of the year, bringing deep snow and bitter cold. In Iowa, where treacherous roads caused hundreds of accidents, snowpack grew up to 20 inches in some places, marking a winter with 180% more precipitation than normal so far. This month's storms reached all the way down to Memphis, Tennessee, where the mayor declared a state of emergency after 6 inches of snow snarled traffic and freezing temperatures caused at least 2 deaths. Meantime, schools and offices were closed in New Orleans and Baton Rouge, Louisiana, last week due to several days of sub-zero weather in the South. The snow comes on the heels of several years of drought that has left parts of the Mississippi River Basin with rainfall deficits of a foot plus. Several more inches of snow has fallen in the Midwest this past week. This week, higher temperatures should melt some of the recent snow and ice. As it melts, that water will bleed into parched waterways in Iowa and beyond, helping restore stream flows decimated by drought. It could also carry the risk of flooding downstream. Most of Minnesota and northern Wisconsin are seeing below-average snowpacks, a sharp contrast to last year when historic snow led to flooding on the Mississippi River. The rest of the Midwest, however, is inundated with above-average snowpack. Around a foot of snow blankets eastern Nebraska into northern Illinois and southern Wisconsin. Drought conditions don't typically improve in the winter, as frozen soils can't soak up precipitation. The warmer-than-normal December allowed rainfall to infiltrate soils across the western Corn Belt. Parts of Iowa received more than double the month's average rainfall. Drought conditions have improved in western Minnesota, Kansas, and Missouri. That was really beneficial because soils were not frozen yet, said Dennis Toady, director of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Midwest Climate Hub. A lot of that was able to soak into the soil. The winter storms that passed through the Midwest even tossed some rain to some parts of the basin, particularly in southern Illinois and Missouri, before the ground froze. Winter weather advisories are in effect throughout the upper Mississippi River basin, and freeze warnings and watches span the lower basin. Last summer's drought brought cascading effects across the basin, including saltwater intrusion threatening drinking water in New Orleans, ongoing marsh fires in Louisiana, and upriver challenges for agriculture and shipping. Farmers reported difficulties getting water to their cattle last year. Public water supplies had to fall back on emergency procedures as their resources dwindled, like in Iowa, where a community considered using recycled wastewater as drinking water. We're lacking water in a lot of places, Toady said. Soils are dry, aquifers are dry, ponds, lakes, rivers are all very dry, so runoff is beneficial. Overnight lows should stay below freezing for much of the Midwest this week, which will preserve some of the snowpack and prevent widespread flooding. That's one thing with this drought. We can take an inundation of water in the inland streams and also the rivers, said Iowa State climatologist Justin Gleason. But the lower part of the Mississippi River Basin, south of Cairo, Illinois, is not likely to see much relief from snowfall in the Midwest after months of drought. Meteorologists are hoping soil moisture levels throughout the region may see some relief come spring. As the El Niño weather pattern continues through the rest of the winter, the upper U.S. could expect warmer temperatures and more active storms over the next 6 weeks. We have some huge rainfall deficits that have built up not only over the last year but the last few years, Toady said. We want to see some improvements in those deficits before we start talking about drought improvement. Turning to the week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state under the heading In the News, Trump cruises to huge caucus victory. Former President Donald Trump notched an early and sizable victory in his campaign for the GOP presidential nomination Monday when he won the Iowa caucuses in a landslide. The former president received 51% of the votes in the contest, the largest victory ever for a competitive Republican caucus. Trump won every county but Johnson, where former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley beat him by one vote, proving he has a firm grip on the GOP electorate. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis came in second, while Haley notched a close third place. Both claim the results as a victory and will go to future contests in New Hampshire and South Carolina. Early caucus call questioned. Iowa GOP Chair Jeff Kaufman criticized national media outlets that called Trump's caucus victory Monday night before many Iowans had finished voting. The calls came a little after 7:30 when only a few precincts had reported results. Networks said those early returns, combined with entrance polling, gave them all the information they needed to make the call. Vivek Ramaswamy, Asa Hutchinson exit. The Republican presidential candidate field thinned out after Monday's caucuses. Vivek Ramaswamy, an Ohio entrepreneur, dropped his presidential bid that evening and endorsed Donald Trump. Former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, who was one of Trump's chief critics in the field, ended his campaign Tuesday. Reynolds revises AEA pitch. 1 week after proposing a major overhaul of Iowa's area education agencies that assist students with disabilities, Governor Kim Reynolds proposed loosening a main restriction in her bill that sparked outcry from teachers, AEA officials, and parents. Reynolds proposed changing the bill to allow AEAs to provide education and media services if requested by school districts and approved by the Iowa Department of Education. School districts still would receive the money for special education services and could decide whether to provide special education through their local AEA or an outside private company. Chuck Grassley released after hospitalization. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley was briefly hospitalized this past week and received antibiotic infusions for an unspecified infection, his office said. Grassley, 90, was released Thursday and expected to return to work. Medical cannabis expansion considered. Iowa lawmakers considered a bill to add raw cannabis flower to the state's medical marijuana program. The program currently only allows cannabis extracts such as capsules and oil vaporizers. Proponents say the law would reduce costs dramatically for patients. Under the heading, they said, "Student success is my central focus, and the goal of my bill is to ensure Iowa's students with disabilities receive the world-class education they deserve. Since introducing it, I've been able to discuss the details with parents and education stakeholders and meet with legislators about what they're hearing from schools and families in their districts." Governor Kim Reynolds on changes to AEA bill. And, "We're going to put America first. We're going to make America great again. Iowa, we love you. Just go out and buy larger tractors and more land. Don't worry about it." Donald Trump, after winning Iowa caucuses. Under the heading Odds and Ends, conversion therapy, Iowa Senate Republicans are considering a bill to prohibit local governments from banning conversion therapy, a method of attempting to convince gay people to become heterosexual that has been widely discredited and is opposed by a bevy of medical and psychiatric organizations. AG sues TikTok. Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd sued social media giant TikTok last week, claiming the app is misleading parents by misrepresenting the content available to teens. Byrd said the app hosts sexual content, profanity, and content about drug use, despite its 12-plus rating in Apple's App Store. Under the heading Water Cooler, UI Athletic Director. Beth Goetz will be the permanent athletic director at the University of Iowa, the school announced Thursday. Goetz served as interim director since August. Her salary will be $850,000 a year, plus bonuses and deferred compensation. Goetz became interim director after Gary Barta, who held the role since 2006, announced his retirement. An open meetings law. Government officials who violate open meetings and records law would face stiffer penalties under a bill introduced by Representative Gary Moore, Republican Bettendorf. Moore said the bill was inspired by the difficulty of obtaining records related to the Davenport building that partially collapsed last year. Turning to the Insight page, Althea Cole writes in her To a Candid World column, "Dump the Iowa caucuses for a primary? No way." The 2024 Iowa caucuses are finally over. They weren't without their blips and hiccups, but with frigid temperatures tempering turnout compared to 2016, no one was shut out of participating due to GOP capacity limits, as I'd feared would happen but hoped would not, nor did the presidential ballot counting process go down in flames. Well done, us. I have many reasons to be glad for the overall statewide success of the Republican caucuses. One in particular, every time something goes wrong, demands that we dump our caucus process in favor of a primary go stronger and louder. This year's comparatively quiet caucuses help keep those demands at bay. With Iowa Democrats already ripped from their lead spot in the lineup by their national leaders, in part because of Iowa's use of the caucus system, it's still worth discussing why Iowa Republicans shouldn't, and certainly won't anytime soon, drop their caucuses in favor of a primary. In short, doing so would require significant changes to state law. It would present loads of logistical questions with no simple answers, create upheaval in the primary process, and shift the burden of cost onto Iowa taxpayers. Let's look at why. Iowa already has a primary election for every general election year in early June. It covers every partisan office except for president and vice president. In the primary, voters registered or willing to register at the time with a major political party choose among candidates who have filed to run for their party's nomination for a particular office on the general election ballot. Not all Iowa primaries involve contested races. When they do, turnout is considerably lower than in a general election. In 2022, just under 23% of Iowa Democrats opted to choose among three candidates in a multi-million dollar primary to challenge U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley. Grassley himself had a primary challenger that year. Almost 27% of Iowa Republicans requested a primary ballot. Would turnout be higher if the presidential nomination were added to Iowa's June primary? Surely not. By then, each major national party usually has its presumptive nominee, the candidate who has secured enough delegates to clinch the nomination. Our presidential nominating contest would go from being the most significant in the country to a totally irrelevant, more or less taxpayer-funded formality. No thanks. What about moving the primary elections to an earlier date to include a presidential vote that retains a modicum of significance? Just the thought makes me shudder. To keep first-in-the-nation status, Iowa would be looking at January or early February primary date. That would cause a sea change in the state electoral process, and candidates for all levels of public office would have to gather signatures and file their nomination papers well over a year before a November general election. What about keeping the other primary elections as they are and holding a separate presidential primary earlier? Adding a whole extra election to the existing workload would be very hard on county elections departments, especially in rural counties with fewer staff. The window of time to prepare for such an election would also be critically small. Last Monday's caucuses happened exactly 70 days after the 2023 city council and school board elections. If that same narrow time existed between city school elections and a presidential primary, preparations for that primary and its onslaught of voters would need to begin well before the city and school elections were finished. Juggling two overlapping elections with different voter qualifications, only registered party members can vote in a primary, would surely put incredible strain on election workers. Plus, should any municipal race require a late November, early December runoff to determine the winner, as it has twice in Cedar Rapids in the last 6 years, yet another election will be tossed into the time frame before mere weeks before the presidential primary. Yikes. Logistical nightmares aside, we'd still face another problem holding a first-in-the-nation primary. Just as our state law requires Iowa to hold its presidential caucuses at 8 days before any other state contest, our friends in New Hampshire have a similar law mandating that they hold the first presidential primary. Should we change to a primary, we pick a needless row with them, and they're not afraid to throw down. The Granite State already fired a warning shot to Iowa Democrats in April 2023 over their mail-in presidential preference cards planned for this year, and earlier this month, New Hampshire's Attorney General sent a cease and desist letter to the Democratic National Committee's Rules and Bylaws Committee. The AG's harshly worded letter was sent after the committee had the gall to instruct New Hampshire Democrats to educate the public that their January 23rd primary is meaningless because it doesn't capitulate to the DNC's new lineup, in which South Carolina was crowned the new leadoff primary state at the request of President Joe Biden, who wanted to reward the first state that was willing to say, "Aw hell, let's go with the old guy who needs his wife to lead him around everywhere in the 2020 primary." So complicated timing and overstepping with our leadoff state counterparts makes switching to a primary a bad idea for presidential nominating. But there's even more to consider. Keep in mind that in Iowa's current partisan primary elections, the winning candidate's name, except in rare circumstances, automatically placed on the November general election ballot. A presidential primary would not accomplish that. Nor should it. If Iowa's 2016 Republican caucus were a primary following the same process as Iowa's existing primary elections, Iowa would see top vote-getter Ted Cruz instead of Donald Trump as the Republican nominee on the 2016 general election ballot. On the 2020 ballot, they would see Bernie Sanders instead of Joe Biden as the Democratic nominee. How, then, did Donald Trump and Joe Biden appear as the nominees on the 2016 and 2020 ballots, respectively? Because a state's presidential nominating contest, whether via a primary or caucuses, never actually determines the names that ends up on the state's general election ballot for president and vice president. It determines how many delegates will be pledged or bound to each candidate in the party's national convention that summer, when the party's chosen candidate is then and only then officially nominated and qualified for placement on a general election ballot as the party nominee. And who actually gets to be one of those delegates choosing the nominee at the national convention? People chosen by the state-level delegates of, you guessed it, the party. It's party business from top to bottom. Party voters indicate their preferred candidate. Party delegates attend party conventions to select the party's nominee, and if the nominee wins the state that November, party-chosen electors assume the prestigious task of casting the state's votes in the Electoral College. But headache-inducing logistical questions aren't even my primary reason, pun intended, for wanting to keep our current format. I love our quirky, rickety caucus process. I love that it's largely run by volunteers who take incredible pride and ownership in the process. I love the fact that a presidential wannabe has to come to our humble flyover state and actually talk to us if they want a snowball's chance of a strong start toward the nomination. I love that we go to meet them and hear what they have to say, often on multiple occasions. I love how we count the ballots as a group. I love that we encourage caucus goers to get involved beyond just casting a quick ballot. And I love how even the most coveted positions of national delegate and presidential elector are chosen through a process that started by gathering in an elementary school gym or church basement with other perfectly ordinary Iowans on a freezing cold January night. Iowans are proud of our perfectly imperfect caucus process, and we are intent on keeping it. Todd Dorman writes in his 24-hour Dorman column, soak in this moment of Hawkeye Hoops magic. Maybe you, like me, have been inundated with pitches promoting mindfulness. My smartwatch urges me to exercise mindfulness twice daily. The watch is not mindful of the fact it's annoying. There are a lot of definitions as to what mindfulness means. There are also books, programs, and classes to help us become mindful. Be mindful of the commercialization of mindfulness. One definition I found says mindfulness is moment-by-moment awareness of thoughts, feelings, bodily sensations, and surrounding environment. So live in the moment, I guess. I generally don't go in for this sort of stuff, but I can think of one good reason to embrace mindfulness. It's the University of Iowa women's basketball team. Grab this moment, be aware, have feelings, and soak in the environment. We may never see anything like it again. As a longtime diehard Hawkeyes fan with an outlook tempered by more heartbreak than triumph, it's hard for me to even fathom this turn of events. As an observer of the train wreck that is our politics and government, watching this team is the hardwood concoction that helps me hang on. UI is generally a place where coaches turn unsung recruits into unlikely heroes. That's a fine tradition. Some of our most memorable seasons came as a surprise. With the exception of wrestling, elite teams have been few and far between. And yet here we are with an elite basketball team that's already played for one national title and could climb to the pinnacle again, smothering its opponents with skill and joy. Cranky pessimists such as myself can only ask, what is happening? Something unbelievable is the answer. And this team's hero is anything but unsung. She's fully sung. Is that a thing? Caitlin Clark does things with a basketball that drop jaws, fill arenas, home and away, and ceaselessly astonish us. I'm not a sports writer, and maybe I should just stay in my lane. But this is about more than sport. This is Iowa history being made before our eyes. Just five packed Iowa home games will draw more Iowans than Donald Trump's caucus vote count. And to my knowledge, the former president has never hit a buzzer beater. This is a team with strong chemistry and deep connections. They seem to genuinely love to play basketball together with wild abandon. Head coach Lisa Bluter has painted a masterpiece. Watch a post-game interview with Clark, and the word I rarely comes up. It's all about we, her team and her teammates. Molly Davis, Kate Martin, Gabby Marshall, Hannah Stolke, and others are the engines that make this team fly. Their performance and personalities are filling the shelves at Raygun. Clark's commitment to team success is more impressive than a three from the logo. And one way you know Clark is bombing the right targets is all the flack she gets. Louisiana coach Kim Mulkey, who sparked speculation that Darth Vader and Voldemort may have produced offspring, recently threw shade at Clark. Nobody's taking 40 shots a game like you see across the country. We are not that kind of team, Mulkey said, obviously referring to Clark. But Mulkey's claim was shot down faster than one of Clark's laser passes from half court to a teammate in the paint. Clark has never taken 40 shots in a game. Her average is 22 shots. Oh, and she leads the nation in scoring and is within striking distance of becoming the all-time leading scorer in women's college basketball history. As a bonus, she gets to live rent-free in Mulkey's head. Maybe Mulkey can relieve some stress by taking a stroll around the court during a game. Clark's detractors are unbelievably many. They spout hot take plates of stupidity wrapped in jealousy and served with a thick gravy of instant social media idiocy. Some guy who 30 years ago might have mumbled on his couch between gulps of beer can now share his mumbles with the world. She's a ball hog, despite ranking 9th all-time in career assists. She complains too much about referees to about calls. Wow, I hope she didn't hurt their feel-bads. She taunts opposing players and puts her emotions on full display. God forbid she show a competitive spirit on the court. I guess she should be an emotionless drone. Stops having so much fun. And does the throng at Carver Hawkeye need to be so loud? Let's use our inside voices. Rarely have so many been so wrong. Clark fills her water bottle with their tears. She gives away the shoes she's used to trample the haters to little girls wearing her number 22 jersey. The point of all of this is don't look away. Don't miss a game. Don't be a naysayer. Ride this train to wherever it goes. Yes, even if you must figure out how to subscribe to Peacock. I know, that's maddening. No matter how this glorious season ends, remain mindful of the magic of this moment. Go Hawks. Turning today's editorial cartoon and community letters, the editorial cartoon from cartoonist Joe Heller from Green Bay, we see a lineup of various talking heads looking somewhat as if they're a game show. First, we have the one labeled fortune teller saying, "It's Biden and Trump." Then a tarot card reader, "It's Biden and Trump." A horoscope teller, "It's Biden and Trump." A clairvoyant saying, "It's Biden and Trump." And then a woman who isn't labeled other than voters saying, "It's Biden and Trump," while she looks at a magic eight ball that says, "Yes, again." The first community letter is from Renee Schultz of Tipton. Column articulates water quality problems. "Thank you, Bob Watson, for stating in Wednesday's Gazette clearly in plain English so everyone can understand the continued and increasing threat to Iowa's water. The plans that Iowa promotes, puts forth, and pays for are not working and will not work. I love it." Renee Schultz of Tipton. Next, Joe Roltgen Sr. of Cedar Rapids writes, "Do citizens still want democracy? Why would citizens, enjoying all the freedoms granted by a constitution of the people, by the people, and for the people, want to be governed by a dictatorship based on principles currently under investigation on many serious counts in our highest courts? I can only hope that the wisdom of our founding fathers will prevail during the election and we can continue to enjoy the personal freedoms granted by representative government." Joe Roltgen Sr. of Cedar Rapids. Next, Dan Myers of Cedar Rapids writes, "Recent weather was not a top story. It almost strains the bounds of credulity that in a world of 8 billion people and with all that is going on in Washington, D.C., Ukraine, Gaza, along with the complicated 2024 political landscape, the most important event that took place on planet Earth on January 12th, according to the front page of Gazette, was that it snowed in Cedar Rapids and the surrounding area." Dan Myers of Cedar Rapids. Next, Mary Hunicky of Cedar Rapids writes, "Now is the time for Dems to get involved. I came home from my precinct caucus Monday evening fired up about democracy and about being a Democrat. Democratic activists are working tirelessly, practicing grassroots politics at its best. They are organizing new constituent groups, such as the Rural Caucus, to empower more Iowans. Democrats are standing up for the state's children and families by protecting public education from Governor Kim Reynolds' efforts to strip away key resources. It is Democrats who are looking out for Iowans' right to accessible health care, clean water, and clean air. There will never be a better time for Democrats to rededicate ourselves to the values we traditionally stand for. If you came home from caucusing ready to join your fellow Democrats in standing up for Iowa values, or if you didn't caucus but now want to get involved, go to www.lincodems.org/get-involved. If you don't live in Linn County, go to www.iowademocrats.org/take-action. The 2024 campaign is heating up. If you care about Iowa, if you care about the welfare of your family and your neighbors, if you care about truth, get involved." Mary Hunicky of Cedar Rapids. Next, David Huddle of Cedar Rapids writes, "Donald Trump caucus victory isn't historic. Trump reaches historic victory might be the silliest and most misleading headline. 50% of 14% of the registered Republican voters is scarcely historic. He's basically the incumbent, and half the voters who showed up didn't want him, and 86% couldn't be bothered. Heck, we went to the Iowa women's game Saturday night and again last night, and we're 71 and 72, and I had complete shoulder replacement from a severely broken arm November 20th, and still have major issues with pain in the shoulder. Meanwhile, the paper continues to not report the total crazy ideas that Trump is espousing, like getting rid of the Constitution, among other lunacy." David Hubble of Cedar Rapids. Next, Pat Myers of Cedar Rapids writes, "Ulrich's uplifting writing is needing. I have wanted to send a note for a very long time praising Kurt Ulrich. I always register a smile when I see that his column is in the paper. My only wish would be to see him more often. When the weather is dreary and freezing, Kurt still manages to put a positive spin on life. The loss of his wife several years ago has been very difficult for him, as evidenced in many of his articles. He writes beautifully and pays homage to the animals and nature that surround him at his home. His words are much needed in our politically charged world at this time, and really, any time. Thank you, Mr. Ulrich. Please continue to write, and if possible, write more often. We need your uplifting, nonpartisan prose." Pat Myers of Cedar Rapids. And finally, Robin Mahaffey of Cedar Rapids writes, "Even non-sport fan enjoy Hlas's columns. I'm a 73-year-old woman who does not follow sports, except the Super Bowl, the commercials, duh. Then why do I read Mike Hlas's columns in the sports section of the Gazette? Because he's such a good writer. His columns are clever and interesting, and I always learn something whether I intend to or not. And I'll admit, it's fun to occasionally throw out some relevant sports tidbit around people who know I don't follow sports. They look at me like, is she leading a double life somewhere else? So thanks to Mike, and if a Beagle ever wins the NCAA pool, Gazette, January 14th, Mike will tell me all about it." Robin Mahaffey of Cedar Rapids. Some quotes of the week. First, Beth Goetz, in a news release announcing her hiring as the permanent director of athletics at the University of Iowa, Goetz says, "I am truly honored and humbled to lead Iowa's storied athletics program, and I am grateful to President Wilson and the search committee for their confidence in my leadership." Next, Keenan Crow with the LGBTQ rights group One Iowa, speaking against a bill that would stop local governments from banning discredited conversion therapy. Crow says, "No one thinks that this is an appropriate form of therapy. Nobody even thinks that it's actually therapy." Next, Marion Police Chief Mike Kitzmiller says, "There was a learning curve for people. A lot of people forgot from driver's ed that you actually have to stop before you can go right," as he was explaining 6,500 citations issued by traffic enforcement cameras in Marion. Next, Andrew Romeo, Governor Ron DeSantis' campaign communications director, in a statement after the Associated Press dubbed Donald Trump the Iowa caucuses winner just 30 minutes after the precinct caucuses started, Romeo says, "It is absolutely outrageous that the media would participate in election interference by calling the race before tens of thousands of Iowans even had a chance to vote." Next, Donald Trump, Iowa caucus winner, praising Attorney General Brenna Byrd, who endorsed his candidate. Trump said about Byrd, "She's going to be your governor someday." You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, January 21st, 2024, on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. I'm your reader, Sharon Feldudo, and we turn to today's obituaries. A few other notices. Joyce Ann Goldsberry, age 90, of Cedar Rapids, died January 17th, Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Thomas R. Saluri, age 73, of Cedar Rapids, died January 18th, Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. John B. Walters, known as Jack, age 103, of Cedar Rapids, died January 18th, Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation of Marion. And Bonnie D. Bemis, age 89, of Marion, died January 18th, Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Joyce Ann Goldsberry, age 90, of Cedar Rapids, died January 17th following a long illness. A funeral mass will be held 11 a.m. Wednesday, January 24th at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church. The family will greet friends 1 hour prior to the service beginning at 10 a.m. at the church. The burial will be at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Joyce loved family birthdays, holidays, and playing with her grandkids. She enjoyed sewing, crossword puzzles, baking for the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House, cooking, and her church circle. Joyce was a member of St. Pius S. Catholic Church and then St. Elizabeth Ann Eaton Catholic Church. Irene Frasher, age 81, of Cedar Rapids, formerly of Marion, passed away January 16th at the Gardens of Cedar Rapids. Irene worked in Bishop's Buffet in Lindell Plaza, Hy-Vee Bakery in Marion, Willow Gardens Care Center as a dietary aide in Marion, and she retired from TJ Maxx in 2015. Per Irene's wishes, there will be no visitation or services at this time. A private service will be held at a later date. Irene is a chosen interment, and Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service assisted with arrangements. Charles Robert Sorensen, age 77, of Marion, died January 17th in his home, surrounded by family. A visitation will be held on Tuesday, January 23rd, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home from 4 to 7 p.m. A private service will be held at a later date. Interment, Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Charles retired as project manager from Aegon in Cedar Rapids. He was a combat veteran of the Vietnam War, where he was awarded the Bronze Star. Charles enjoyed traveling in his retirement. He also enjoyed all Iowa Hawkeye sports and events. Ricky L. Marlett, age 81, made his journey home on January 12th under the compassionate care of Mercy Hospice House in Hiawatha, surrounded by family and friends. Rick spent his youth in Lyons, Ohio, and serves as a firefighter for Lyons, Ohio, and Albion, Michigan, and then as fire chief in Kalamazoo Township in Eastwood, Michigan, and Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin. He moved to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to be near his family. Please visit Bross Chapel for the full obituary. Nancy Ellen Stikeleather Thomas, beloved mother, wife, musician, and community volunteer, continued her journey in God's love on December 2nd in Cedar Rapids. She was 91. Celebration of Life, 1 p.m. Saturday, March 16th, United Methodist Church of Mount Vernon, with visitation 1 hour prior. Private family burial, Mount Vernon Family Cemetery. She served as dean of the local chapter of the American Guild of Organists, as an accompanist for high school musical productions and competitions, and for hundreds of weddings and funerals. She served as organist and director of music for the Mount Vernon United Methodist Church for many years, where she enjoyed bringing young people into the musical life of the congregation. She was a longtime volunteer with the St. Luke's Hospital Breast and Bone Center, and her work with the League of Women Voters helped bring attention to the community need for child care. She also had a flair for sewing and created her own clothing for decades. Arrangements are with Stuart Baxter. Sorry, the next one's not loading. James Tannery, age 77, of Toddville, passed away January 12th at home, surrounded by family. No services are planned at this time. James was stationed at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, while serving in the Army from 1966 to 1968. He worked at General Electric in Utica, New York, and afterwards employed by Lockheed Martin in Syracuse. He relocated to Cedar Rapids and began working for Rockwell Collins. James enjoyed everything outdoor-related, such as chopping wood, fishing, hunting, and tending to his garden. He liked alpine skiing and riding his motorcycle. James loved doing repair work, especially mechanical in nature. Evelyn Bechica, known as Shmoo, age 95 of Cedar Rapids, passed away on January 16th at the Gardens of Cedar Rapids. Celebration of Life service will be 11 a.m. Thursday, January 25th, at Bross Chapel in the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. Burial will be in the Czech National Cemetery. Evelyn always spoke fondly of the years she spent working at Drugtown as a clerk in Cedar Rapids. After retirement, she found her passion for hobby photography and liked going to garage sales, writing books, sewing clothes, and occasionally visiting a casino with her husband. Her biggest thrill was going on bus trips all over the United States. She loved finding round barns and learning their history. Margaret Irene McAllister, known as Marge, of Palmetto, Florida, passed away on January 9th in Bradenton, Florida. She was born in Fairbanks, Iowa. She will be interred beside her beloved husband at Sarasota National Cemetery. Private celebration of life will be held on February 1st, 2024. She worked at Life Investors, Coe College, and Quaker Oats. Peter R. Eliff, a resident of Marion, passed away on January 19th after fighting a courageous battle with cancer. He was born March 7th, 1962. Peter worked in manufacturing and machining management and as a consultant to Enterprise Resource Planning, contributing his skills to Eliff Steel Service, Sadler Machine, and Global Shop Solutions. Notably, he founded and served as the president of Dunes Integration LLC up until his illness. Peter proudly served his country as a Marine, embodying the values of courage, honor, and commitment. The family invites friends and acquaintances to join in an open house celebration of Peter's life at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, 3855 Cats Drive in Marion, on Saturday, February 3rd, from 2 to 4 p.m. The family of Melvin Eugene Wise, known as Fuzzy, age 86 of Cedar Rapids, is sad to announce his passing on January 13th. Melvin was proud of his family and enjoyed talking about his brother's athletic accomplishments. As a teenager, he saw Patsy Cline at the Grand Ole Opry. After high school, he worked at Sanitary Dairy, Orlando Lake Swiss Belly Farms, retiring after 38 years. He was a hard worker, often picking up extra shifts to provide for his family. Sports were a huge part of his life. He bowled and played softball. He was an avid Chicago Cubs and Iowa Hawkeyes fan and enjoyed sharing stories about the 1950 to 1960s Iowa Hawkeye sports teams. Melvin knew how to brighten the day for so many, which was evident during his hospital stays, always telling stories and making the doctors and nurses smile and laugh. Per his wishes, there will be no service celebrating his life. Instead, in his memory, treat people right and be kind. Bonita M. Wilson, age 92, of Van Horn, was welcomed into heaven on January 17th at the Keystone Nursing and Care Center following a short illness. A private graveside service at Salem Cemetery, Van Horn, will be held later this year. Carol Jean Storm, age 93, of Ely, formerly of Maryland, died in her home Tuesday evening, January 9th. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, January 27th, at Hope Evangelical Church in North Liberty. Janet Marie Murphy, born Janet Marie Rundle, age 84, of Solon, passed away January 18th at Mercy Hospital in Iowa City. Funeral Mass will be 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, January 23rd, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Solon, with burial to follow in St. Mary's Cemetery. Bross Chapel in the Ava Center in Solon is in charge of arrangements. David W. Brown, age 74, of Marion, passed away peacefully at St. Luke's Hospital on January 15th, surrounded by his family following chronic health issues. for family and friends, a celebration of life will be held at the venue at Kingston Steakhouse on Boyson Road Northeast in Cedar Rapids on Friday, January 26th from 6 to 8 p.m. A visitation will be held Saturday, January 27th at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church in Hiawatha from 10 to 11 a.m. A funeral mass will begin at 11 a.m. and a luncheon in Seton Hall of the parish will follow the funeral. A private interment of the reins will be held at a later date with immediate family. Elfriede Hansen, born Elfriede Markman, died January 18th in Cedar Rapids. She was born November 29th, 1936, in Anamosa. She worked at Woolworths and then at Collins in Cedar Rapids. Pete and Elfriede were longtime members of St. Stephen's Lutheran Church. Elfriede was the consummate gift giver, and nothing gave her more pleasure than giving presents. She loved shopping and took great pride in snagging a bargain at Kohl's or Von Maur. She beamed when she saw her boys or grandkids. She was an expert Wheel of Fortune player and never missed watching Iowa men's or women's basketball games. She read the Gazette newspaper with a fine-tooth comb every day and discussed politics and current events until the very last few days of her life. Funeral services will take place at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home Saturday, January 27th at 11 a.m. There will be a visitation prior from 9 to 11 a.m. Interment will take place at a later time. Marva Ann Hanna, age 90, passed away peacefully on January 18th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, January 27th at Bethlehem Lutheran Church in Vinton, with Reverend Ann Williams officiating. Visitation will be held from 9 a.m. until service time at the church. A private family interment will be held at Evergreen Cemetery in Vinton. Marva was a homemaker for her family and an active member of Bethlehem Lutheran Church. She enjoyed sewing, quilt making, square dancing, traveling, RV camping, and spending time with family, friends, and grandchildren from near and far. George Taylor Henry, on January 14th, the Greatest Generation bid farewell to Renaissance man George Taylor Henry on his 101st birthday. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, February 2nd at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, February 3rd at First Congregational Church, located at 361 17th Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids. World War II interrupted his studies as he enlisted in the Army Air Corps in 1942, piloting B-24 Liberator bombers out of Italy until the end of the war. Returning to Co., he graduated in 1949 and started his commercial photography business. In 1956, George took a rafting trip in Utah and went from passenger to stand-in boatman to Whitewater River guide for the next 40-plus years. Many Cedar Rapidians joined him on the trip of a lifetime down the Green or Yampa Rivers in Dinosaur National Monument. After more than 350 multi-day trips and 25,000 river miles, he laid claim to unique friendships with passengers Bobby and Ethel Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, John Glenn, Jim Whitaker, Andy Williams, Art Buchwald, and others. His river exploits were documented by Carrie J. Hahn in his Iowa Traveler series in the 1990s and in his own book on river running experiences, Row Away from the Rocks. George has been recognized for his volunteerism throughout the Cedar Rapids community. As per George's wishes, instead of flowers, donations can go to the Vince Shute Wildlife Sanctuary in Minnesota. Leonard Scott Emerson III joined his mother in heaven on January 16th. He was born in Cedar Rapids on June 15th, 1963. He resided there for most of his life. He worked for Smulikoff for over 29 years and was a proud teamster. He loved vehicles, especially his truck and motorcycle. One of his best memories was riding his Harley cross-country from Iowa to Washington State. Another favorite pastime was taking the coon dogs to northern Iowa for hunting. There is no service at this time. There will be a private graveside service at a later date. Pamela Rose Henkel, age 70, of Flowery Branch, Georgia, formerly of Garrison, Iowa, passed away Friday, January 5th. She retired as a customer service manager for Rico Paper Company. A memorial service was held in the Chapel of Flanagan Funeral Home in Georgia. Marilyn Joan Palmer Lloyd, age 93, of Prairieburg, passed away at the Guttenberg Care Center on January 15th. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, February 3rd, at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Prairieburg, with interment in the St. Joseph Cemetery. Friends may call after 9 a.m. Saturday at the church. Marilyn was a member of the United Church of Christ in Central City, where she taught Sunday school for many years. She was also a member of the Hills Mills Homemakers Club, Central City Historical Society, and the Merry Widows Red Hat Group from Anamosa. As she raised her family, Marilyn was a 4-H leader, softball coach, and homemaker. In 1979, Marilyn joined St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion in Prairieburg. Throughout Marilyn's life, she worked at Rockwell Collins in Anamosa and Cedar Rapids, and before retiring, she worked at City State Bank in Central City, where she helped with many civic activities and volunteering in rural communities. Mary Yvonne Livingston Fisher, born August 16, 1926, passed away on January 14, 2024. She was a member of Delta 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 Sorority, the Scottish Highlanders marching band, and a business manager for the student-run Frivol magazine. She worked at the Akron, Ohio Beacon Journal, was deputy treasurer in Portage County, Wisconsin, and executive secretary of Girl Scouts in Stephen Point, Wisconsin. In 1960, she and her husband moved to Vinton, where she was a high school teacher at Blairstown in Vinton. She later served as librarian and board member of the Vinton Public Library. She was also chairman of the 1988 Benton County History Book, was a pipe organist for several churches, member of PEO Chapter HG, Minor Chord, and Mentor Literature. She enjoyed playing bridge, traveling, and spending time in Door County, Wisconsin. Celebration of life is being planned for a later date. Richard Nichols, age 89, of Anamosa, died January 15th at Monticello Nursing and Rehabilitation. Richard was employed as an accountant at the Maquoketa Valley REC and retired after 37 years of service. He was a former member of the Lions Club in Anamosa and enjoyed hunting, ice fishing, gazing at the stars through his telescope, and spending time with family. He was a piano player and played classical music, but loved Dixieland jazz, attending the Bix Beiderbecke Festival in Davenport as often as he could. Mr. Nichols' family will receive friends from 2 to 5 p.m. Thursday, January 25th, at the Getch Funeral Home in Anamosa. Military honors will be accorded by the United States Army and the Anamosa Veterans Honor Guard at approximately 4:30 p.m. Michael John Kepros, known as Mike, age 87, of Marion, passed away Sunday, January 14th. A vigil service will be held at 4:30 p.m. Monday, January 22nd, at Murdoch Funeral Home and cremation service in Marion, followed by the rosary. Following the rosary, visitation will proceed until 7 p.m. on Monday at the funeral home. A massive Christian burial will begin at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, January 23rd, at St. Joseph Catholic Church, located at 1790 14th Street in Marion, where an additional visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the Mass. Burial will follow at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Keith Austin Wymore, age 97, of Cedar Rapids, died January 16th at home surrounded by family. Services, 11 a.m. Wednesday, January 24th at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories, where visitation will begin at 9 a.m. until service time. Burial, private at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. During World War II, as soon as he turned 18, he enlisted in the Army. He was commissioned as a second lieutenant in July 1945 and then stationed in Hawaii until discharge in November 1946. He got his master's in education for University of Iowa and enjoyed teaching and working with younger kids, so he spent the next 30 years as an elementary school principal at Buchanan, Hayes, Hiawatha, and Wright schools. Keith was very active with youth-oriented organizations such as the Scouts and a longtime member of the Optimist Club. Keith Sokol retired in 1989 from administration to the golf course, but continued to substitute teach for another 25-plus years. He loved sports and especially if it involved the Hawkeyes. At age 96, he was still working security at as many Hawkeye events as he could possibly fit in. Keith also loved to travel, and one of his most memorable trips was the Eastern Iowa Honor Flight to Washington, D.C. in 2011. Keith was a faithful member of Trinity Lutheran Church. Turning to sports, Mike Kloss writes, Proctor saved Saturday for Carver fans in Iowa City. Big picture, Saturday was a winning day for Iowa Hawkeyes athletics. Caden Proctor, a 6'7", 360-pound offensive lineman from Des Moines and Southeast Polk High, verified the speculation of the previous 3 days and announced he is transferring from Alabama to Iowa. A big get for the Hawkeyes, to say the least. Proctor started all 14 games for the Crimson Tide as a first-year freshman, the last game being a national playoff semifinal at the Rose Bowl. He was a first-team freshman, all SEC honoree. Yes, it would seem Iowa would be able to make good use for Proctor, who flipped on a commitment to the Hawkeyes last year to roll with the Tide. With a former playoff quarterback in Cade McNamara and a playoff tackle in Proctor and a defense chock-full of talented veterans, maybe all it will take is the right offensive coordinator to make Iowa a playoff threat now that 12 teams are getting into that party next year instead of just four. Who might that OC be? As January nears February, the answer is murkier than ever. Proctor was at Carver Hawkeye Arena on Saturday afternoon to watch number 2 Purdue beat Iowa in men's basketball 84-70. So it wasn't a perfect day in River City. Proctor arrived at the arena wearing Alabama crimson, or maybe it was just red. It had an Air Jordan logo, not the Alabama script A. Still, the bright red made Proctor stand out in the crowd as much as his size. He soon blended into the crowd in one way, though. He said he bought the black Iowa football shirt he switched into. Another really big man wasn't as kind to the Hawkeye world. Purdue 7'4", 300-pound Zach Edey made his farewell appearance to Carver an unkind one. Edey had 30 points and 18 rebounds and looked like, well, a really, really big man with talent, and with the knowledge of how to use his size and length against normal-sized major college big men. You can moan about foul calls Edey didn't get or the Hawkeyes did, but the Boilermakers weren't losing this game and Edey wasn't getting outplayed. The Big Ten standings say Purdue is in second place, a half game behind Wisconsin at 6-2, but the Boilers are the best league the league has to offer and will prove it over 20 games. Iowa 6'10 freshman Owen Freeman has been a revelation so far this season, so much more polished than you might expect for a rookie post player. Facing a 6-inch height disadvantage against Edey on top of the Canadian skill set, Freeman had two shots blocked and learned some hard lessons. There have been better days for the rookie, and there will be many more. Purdue head coach Matt Painter has been the big man whisperer of college basketball over the last several years. Likes what he has seen from Freeman, a 6-time Big Ten Freshman of the Week. He's got a combination of size and athleticism, Painter said. He can move. Sometimes the guys that can move don't have the strength. He has both. Now he's got to build where he can drive the ball from the high post. He can shoot from the perimeter, because he's got that other stuff. He's got the intangibles, and his competitive spirit's high, and that's sometimes what you don't see in a big. Edey's finally leaving the Big Ten after this season. Meanwhile, Hawkeye football and men's basketball should have big dudes to savor in 2024 and 2025. And turning to the time machine, a look back at the people, places, and events in eastern Iowa, Omaha crime boss. Tom Dennison was born in Delaware County in 1859 by Diane Fannin Langton, correspondent. Thomas Dennison, who would grow up to be an Omaha political and crime boss, was born on a farm in Delaware County in 1859. His first job was putting in waste paper boxes in Des Moines in early 1870s. He worked on Iowa farms from 1873 to 1879, when he headed to Colorado to work in the silver mines. He then became a professional gambler in Leadville, Colorado, later buying into the Arcade Gambling House in Denver. In 1890, Dennison moved to Lincoln, Nebraska, and then to Omaha within 2 years. Dennison became a protege of Omaha Bee editor Edward Rosewater, who ran the Republican political organization in the city. When Rosewater became more interested in state and national affairs, Omaha became Dennison's domain. Under Dennison, the organization transitioned into criminal enterprises, operating out of the city's third ward, where gambling, drinking, and prostitution flourished. The defining episode in Dennison's career, and the one that almost sent him to prison, was a daring train robbery on November 4, 1892 in western Iowa. As the Sioux City and Pacific Railroad train out of Omaha drew near California Junction, a settlement in Harrison County, Iowa, just across the Missouri River from Nebraska, a ruthless young robber jumped off the train, rolled down an embankment, and disappeared with $15,000 in diamonds taken by brute force from traveling salesman W.G. Pollock of New York. The diamonds would be worth more than $500,000 today. William A. Pinkerton from the famous private detective agency interviewed witnesses on the train who identified the robber as James Burke, alias Kid McCoy, alias Frank Shercliffe. Shercliffe was arrested, convicted, and sentenced to 17 years in the penitentiary at Fort Madison. Political pressure, including by Dennison, was applied to Iowa Governor Frank Jackson to have Shercliffe pardoned to no avail. Rich gamblers in Denver and Omaha tried again to get Shercliffe pardoned when Iowa Governor Francis Marion Drake, for whom the university is named, took office, again without success. Shercliffe finally was released on parole by Iowa Governor Leslie M. Shaw on November 28, 1900. The only letters in favor of the parole came from John Baldwin of Council Bluffs and Judge N. M. Hubbard of Cedar Rapids, who said he was returning a favor for Congressman David Mercer of Omaha, who had been very useful to him in getting a bill through Washington, the Gazette reported. Shercliffe returned to crime almost immediately after being released and was caught attempting another diamond robbery. He was returned to prison to complete his original sentence. He again asked Dennison for help getting out of prison, but Dennison wasn't interested this time. Shercliffe, in turn, decided to provide state's evidence incriminating Dennison, saying Dennison had received the stolen diamonds in the 1892 train heist and in a 1902 diamond robbery in Clinton. In April 1904, a Harrison County grand jury indicted Dennison on charges of receiving the stolen diamonds from the Pollock robbery in 1892. Dennison engineered efforts to defeat the Harrison County attorney in the 1904 election. Shercliffe, in fear of his life, was put under police protection in Harrison County. The Des Moines Capital newspaper interviewed Dennison, who admitted he had put up money to secure Shercliffe's parole in 1900. Of course, political influence entered into the case, he stated. A document also surfaced that showed Dennison had hired H.G. McMiller, an attorney and editor of the Cedar Rapids Republican, to serve as Shercliffe's lawyer. But at Dennison's trial in June 1905, moved to Red Oak on a change of venue, Dennison denied knowing Shercliffe other than a gambler in Salt Lake City. The jury acquitted Dennison on any role in the diamond robbery. 3 years later, in September 1908, Dennison testified against Shercliffe, who had been charged with second-degree murder in the killing of a Leadville, Colorado saloon keeper in 1893. Shercliffe was convicted and sent to prison again. After his acquittal, Dennison resumed control of his Omaha organization, which was credited with electing Cowboy Jim Dahlman mayor of Omaha 8 times. Omaha voters elected a reform candidate in 1918, but his efforts to go after Dennison's organization were undermined by violence. Dennison and his candidate were back in office in 1921. By 1932, during Prohibition, Dennison was 73 and in federal court, accused in a liquor conspiracy trial. Witnesses testified he visited gangster Al Capone in Chicago to learn how to modify Omaha's liquor syndicate to mirror Capone's. The jury deadlocked and a mistrial was declared. With his health declining, Dennison retired in 1933, ending his 30-year reign in Omaha. On February 14, 1934, Dennison, who was never convicted of a crime, died in San Diego, California, from injuries sustained in a January 27th car accident. His body was returned to Omaha for burial, with hundreds of citizens attending his funeral. And that brings me to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, January 21st, 2024. I have been your reader, Sharon Falduto, reading to you from my kitchen table in Coralville, looking out at our drought-reducing 20 inches of snow in our backyard that causes it to be very difficult for my dog to go outside and do her business. Remember that you can access a recording of this or any other Iris recording at any time on our website, iowaradioreading.org. We do welcome your comments, and I thank you very much for listening.